Welcome back, everybody, to Uncensored CMO. Now, one of my all-time favourite brands ever is Guinness. So I'm really excited to be joined in this episode of the Uncensored CMO by the brand director himself, who's responsible for the brand all around the world and is also a fourth-generation employee, which brings an extra bit of intrigue to it. So I'm delighted to be joined by Stephen O'Kelly. Welcome to the show.
Delighted to be here. And yeah, no pressure being the fourth generation.
You must be close to royalty in Dublin, I would assume, given that, you know, you're coming from, you know, four generations of Guinness working family. But you're the first marketer in
Correct.
The family, is that right? Well, tell me what your forebears did.
Well, the rest are, they're much more engineering backgrounds. You know, there's always kind of creativity, you know, in the family. So my dad was very much into his music. So he played the piano, plays guitar, et cetera, et cetera. And we're all encouraged like to play musical instruments. In my case, it was the violin. And of course, if you're Irish, you have either a hurling stick or a tin whistle put into your hand when you're four. So I guess we're really encouraged kind of to be very creative. So I know you did a podcast on Lego. So I was a huge Lego fan, you know, and loved building skyscrapers and all that kind of creative stuff. So I think, you know, creativity is very much kind of in the family. And I think very much kind of in my blood. So interestingly, I studied law. An interesting path like to get to where I am now. But I think after 4 years of law, I was pretty clear, I don't want to do this for the rest of my life. And was very interested in kind of marketing and kind of, you know, again, kind of the kind of creative outlet from marketing. And, you know, again, I guess that kind of combination of language, which, you know, the legal training kind of really gave me, but also that creativity. It was kind of like the perfect fit. And of course, if you're going to work in marketing and you're an Irish guy, there's no better company to kind of cut your teeth than what was Guinness, and of course, is now Diageo. So I started as a summer student, believe it or not, about a month after I left college, and had the opportunity then to apply for the Guinness Graduate Scheme a few months later. And thankfully, after a very extensive process, which took 6 months, I managed to be successful. And that took me to London. So I trained as a graduate in London in Park Royal, which is where we had our brewery at the time. And spent 4 years there, you know, working between trade marketing. I also did like sales for a year. So I carried the bag, as we say, and then finally worked in consumer marketing or brand marketing. And then back to Ireland, where I kind of did a variety of roles, but like it was my first time to kind of work fully on Guinness as a senior brand manager, which was really, really interesting, actually. And kind of my first of three trips, you know, on Guinness. So senior brand manager back in kind of the early 2000s, then came back as marketing director for Guinness Western Europe 2012. And then I went to Nairobi in Kenya. So I worked on the other side, you know, on Guinness there, and then back to Ireland, like to be global brand director. So this is my third time to kind of work on Guinness, and so far I haven't ruined the brand.
Very good,
which is great.
Well, yep. four generations, you've yep. been on the brand three times, so hopefully be expecting a fourth moment from you as well, just to complete the set. But before we talk a bit more about your career and the, sure. the Guinness brand as well, how far back does your family go? And you must have grown up hearing stories about the brand and that kind of thing.
Yeah, very much. You know, and again, as I said, like they're much more kind of on the engineering kind of background side of things, and kind of the more research and development kind of angle as opposed to like marketing or the brand per se. I mean, it was the brand we talked about around the table, because when you ask your dad, well, how was your day at the office? It turned out his office was here, you know, in the breweries. And, you know, if my dad were here now, he could regale you with so many amazing stories and lore and, you know, everything around the Guinness family and the workers. And what was always really clear, though, and we really appreciated, was how Guinness looked after its people. And like, fun fact, like the employees and their family, you know, had free medical care. And as a little kid, you know, I benefited from that, you know, as did my dad, my mom, and the previous kind of generations. So I guess that's kind of something that always kind of struck me, is, you know, that we had this huge support actually from the company. And you always, you know, really got the sense that like the company genuinely cared about the welfare, you know, of its workers. And again, you know, for good reason, like sort of healthy and happy workers is good for business. But I think, you know, very much ahead of their time. And that probably goes all the way back, I think, to Arthur Guinness himself, you know, the founding further. And again, you know, when you kind of look at the archives and read kind of what was done for people kind of way back then, he was such a visionary, you know, and so ahead of his time, you know, because you think, you know, employee welfare, you know, even sustainability, oh gosh, these are very kind of recent concepts, but actually that was very much the heart of how the company operated from day one. We're here in Dublin, obviously, now, but if you go around the city, you'll see St. Stephen's Green, which was actually built and paid for by the Guinness family, you know, and again, like, you know, they saw the value of kind of having those sort of amenities in the city. Only a few steps away from us, we have St. Patrick's Cathedral, which is one of the most famous cathedrals like in Ireland. And again, the Guinness family paid to restore actually the cathedral because it was, you know, falling to pieces. And then there's a lot of housing, you know, that you'll see in the city centre, which again was built by the Guinness family for their workers. So yeah, of course, because it's such kind of a rich history and a storied kind of brand. Yeah, I grew up with it. And as I say, when I graduated and decided I wanted to build a career in marketing, there was just one choice in my mind, you know, and as I say, I was just lucky enough to be chosen.
Now, for everyone listening at the moment, we are in the storehouse as we record this in the Connoisseur Bar. You've got a portrait of Arthur Guinness sat right behind you, or hung up, should I say, right behind you. Guinness is intrinsically linked to Ireland, isn't it? And I know we just had St. Patrick's Day. How important is the link between the two? And I know when I travel the world with the job I do, you know, St. Patrick's Day is celebrated everywhere now, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really interesting, actually. I would say the link to Ireland is really, really different by country. So obviously in Ireland, it's, you know, essentially like national icon brands, like an emblem of Ireland. And even actually the harp on the glass is also the harp of the Irish government, except the Irish government harp is flipped the other way around because we trademarked it.
Well, you trademarked it. You had the harp before the government did.
Correct. Wow. Yeah, exactly. Before they kind of made it a national, whatever, you know, icon of the Irish government. And interestingly, if you get a letter with the Guinness harp in it, you're happy because it might be your paycheck or something nice. If you get a letter from the Irish government and the harp's the other way around, you're like, it's probably a tax bill. So obviously a huge brand in Ireland. Like obviously in the US, you know, a lot of Irish diaspora kind of there, like very, very close kind of links to Ireland and Irish kind of culture. So that's a big, big part. And of course, same goes for GB, a lot of Irish diaspora, but also a huge kind of link to Ireland. I mentioned I was in Nairobi in Kenya for 2.5 years. So I was marketing director out there for East Africa. You know, in terms of like their understanding of the link to Ireland, I remember saying, you know, hey, you know, Guinness from Ireland, you know, and they're like, where is that? You know, is that a small town in Scotland? And I'm like, okay, fine. And what's really interesting about like those countries and Africa in particular, where we've got a massive and very, very successful kind of business, is they see it as their own. You know, so you go to Lagos, they see Guinness and FES, as it is there, Foreign Extra Stout, as Nigerian, you know, and same goes for Kenya, East Africa, and they see it as their own. And I think that's a wonderful thing because it makes Guinness like a naturally very multicultural brand. And that makes it very different to other beers, which tend to be, you know, more international kind of premium kind of, they show up, you know, they make an art of kind of showing like exactly the same, if that makes sense. Whereas for Guinness, actually, it shows up quite different. And you could say, gosh, that makes it complex, and it does, because we want to make the brand cohesive. But it makes us work harder to understand which bits kind of stay true, irrespective of the country, or indeed, as you say, the link to Ireland. But then which bits we want to be different and should be different. And I just think it's fascinating when you go to the Caribbean or you go to Asia, or as I say, like some of our big Africa markets, the link to Ireland is not relevant or not even known. But that said, you know, you mentioned St. Patrick's Day. We just had our biggest ever St. Patrick's Day in Singapore, of all places. Yeah. And I think we had up to 40,000 people. Can you believe? I was trying to work out what percentage of the Singapore population that might, it's quite a lot, right? You know, that's definitely not all Irish people kind of going to that, you know. So a huge congrats like to the team. They did an amazing job. It was down in the Keys. 1980s. And yeah, I think that was pretty much like double of where they got to last year in terms of attendance. So yeah, it's a truly global brand. I think we're in over 150 countries worldwide, which is why I looked stressed. But it's an absolutely fascinating brand for that.
You're clearly a brand on a roll. I mean, I know, yeah. In the UK, you achieved Britain's favourite pint last year. Massive
Correct.
Congratulations. And Marketing Week made you brand of the year.
Yeah.
But what I think is interesting, you've had three stints on the brand.
Yeah.
When I was growing up, you know, Guinness was sort of like the old man's drink. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it hasn't always been as successful as it is today. So
Correct.
I'd love to find out what the journey's been like, and maybe what's the secret to its turnaround, its renovation to become the brand it is today.
When I joined as senior brand manager, that was for Ireland only. And what was interesting at that point, because we'd just made ads like Surfer, etc., which again, you know, brought incredible fame, right, you know, to the brand. But there was a sense of, well, A, lager was increasing in popularity and it was very, very competitive. But I think there was a sense of we'd forgotten about the quality of the pints, you know, and we hadn't spoken about that for quite a long time. So that was kind of the big, big task we kind of set ourselves to do, was to kind of really elevate the quality of the pint, remind people of how natural it is. You know, so you've got your four kind of ingredients of barley, hops, yeast, and of course water. And people didn't kind of know that. And they'd kind of fallen out of love with the actual liquid itself. So it's kind of really interesting to kind of, because I think that's a lot of the genesis of what we see now in terms of the emphasis we put on quality. We have an army of quality ambassadors who go around like the pubs and ensure, you know, that the quality, we have the 5 C's, you know, which is a kind of a blueprint, I guess, for quality, you know, and we invest a huge amount of money in ensuring that quality kind of is there. So that was kind of the challenge there. And then if I kind of move on to when I was marketing director of Western Europe, so again, it wasn't just Ireland anymore. Now it was Ireland and GB, and we also have partner markets in continental Europe. So we've got a very significant business, obviously, between those three territories. And gosh, it was a really tough time, actually, for Guinness, in particular in GB, because we had the craft beer revolution happening. So this was between 2012 and 2015. And in fact, some of our biggest customers were introducing their own stouts, you know, and some of our most important customers, you know, were introducing their own stouts. And we were being delisted, you know.
Guinness being delisted.
We were being delisted, you know, and I won't get into the specifics of any particular customers, but it was very significant. And of course, we declared crisis. And we created a project called Project Gladiator, which was essentially a kind of, how would you put it, like a double down on the on-trade and really, really intensely kind of looking after our customers. And of course, you know, as kind of time went by, if I'm honest with you, consumers made the decision, you know, because the quality of Guinness was, you know, in a different league, but also just the desirability of the brand, the iconic nature of the brand. So it sort of naturally kind of eased itself out, but it was a proper crisis, you know. And as you say, when you kind of think about now and the size of the brand and success of the brand in GB, that was very hard won, you know, and certainly not a straightforward journey. And then you also kind of mentioned kind of the relevance piece. And yeah, absolutely. Like traditionally kind of older male, you know, that kind of a profile. And it's really interesting kind of for me. Obviously, you know, we in our marketing, like our core target is actually kind of male and female, you know, and not even like age specific. You know, what we want to do is kind of talk to the broadest number of consumers possible, you know, and that's good for the brand. And it opens it up to the biggest kind of recruitment base. But one thing I noticed, which I think was such a turning point in terms of like Guinness being cool, in particular amongst younger generations, but also becoming more bilingual, is COVID.
Now I've got a theory on this because actually COVID, as soon as we couldn't go to the pub,
yeah,
and what were we missing? We're missing a pint of Guinness.
Yeah.
And you also, I think, nailed your communication. I remember, I mean, at System One, we measured every COVID ad because suddenly we had no customers because people were stop testing advertising. We thought, what are we going to do? Why don't we test every COVID ad and try and learn about the best response?
Amazing. Yeah.
And actually, your Guinness response, I mean, it was just after St. Patrick's Day, actually,
that
the lockdown happened. So you went from this amazing St. Patrick's Day reminder of being together and what it's like being together. Suddenly, we couldn't be together.
Yeah.
And it's almost felt like at the time, time that Guinness was the brand that was staying loyal and reminding us what it will be like when we get back together. And as soon as the pubs opened again, it almost seemed to be Guinness was, you know, the moment that we got back together. I mean, that's how I interpret it, looking at all the ads from the time.
Well,
that's how it felt.
I couldn't summarize it any better myself, but you're dead right. But it was a very concerted effort. And I actually wasn't working on Guinness at the time of COVID. I was global brand director on Smirnoff. Yeah, there's a kind of a GB angle and there's an Ireland angle here, but the Irish government in their wisdom had this interesting kind of habit of deciding to announce a lockdown, usually on the 6-1 news on a Friday evening. If you can imagine, you know, that the publicans have got all their stock in, they're ready for a big weekend. And of course, these lockdowns were kind of opening and closing. So of course, when they opened up, it was a mad dash, you know, to get restocked up, et cetera, et cetera. And if you can imagine then, like this kind of happens, then all that beer spoils. So one thing Diageo did in Guinness was we basically paid for that. Not everybody kind of did, which I think just created enormous kind of goodwill. And I know that might seem like a small step, but it made a huge difference, you know, to the trades, again, who are, you know, like to their cash flow. Can you imagine like mid-COVID, like, you know, they were not making very much money, but it also meant that they could kind of hold on to their staff, et cetera, et cetera. But we had this program called Raise the Bar, which was, again, you know, thinking of our investment, multi-year investment in the on-trade. So the whole idea of Guinness coming back stronger and reaching like a number one on-trade share, et cetera, I do believe is hugely attributable to that level of investment. And if you can imagine, that investment was used to create outdoor furniture, you know, of course branded, but that's expensive stuff to kind of do, you know. And of course, with a lot of the pubs, people can go inside. So they were like basically outside. So we paid for awnings and chairs and tables, et cetera, which again, I think the trades were really, really grateful for. So I think we built up huge goodwill. And I think we really, really demonstrated our commitment to our customers, but also I think to consumers as well. And it's interesting you mentioned the piece around, you know, the communion kind of aspect and Guinness really, really representing that. And our brand purpose on Guinness is we believe in the power and goodness of communion. And I think we really, really brought that to life, you know, kind of not just words, but actions as well, to kind of really stand for our purpose. And it has, it's just been such a turning point, I think, for the brand. COVID could have devastated the brand, and in fact, quite the opposite, you know. But it also spurred on innovation, because of course, people were drinking at home, not in the pub, and hence like innovations like Microdraft, Nitro Surge, which have basically kind of transformed that quality experience, like at home, that draft quality experience, came, you know, the afterburners were put on basically on the back of COVID. So I definitely think, yeah, an ill wind blows some good, I guess, in the case there. And then one, yeah, like in terms of the younger consumers, at one point we were allowed to serve Guinness through these little kind of hatches almost. Yeah. So in the same way people were getting coffees, you know, like through these little kind of like whole, like, so the pubs did that as well. And it was just kind of hilarious to see people being handed out pints of Guinness through these hatches, but being so delighted to be able to do it. And then of course they were on the streets, you know, but everybody was just so grateful, so well behaved, you know, handing the pints glass, you know, back, you know. And the interesting thing for me, what really struck me was it was all young people drinking Guinness, and there was a complete mix, male, female, you name it. And that really, really struck me, because I just think the values of the brand, and as you say, that kind of Guinness being a kind of a symbol of coming back together. And, you know, I think that, and I think that's really endured.
You dropped a little thing into conversation just a minute ago. You said, oh, of course we provided the furniture, which I thought was lovely, actually, the generosity of the brand, but also how distinctive your assets are and how they're everywhere. I mean, even flying into Dublin yesterday, like literally wall-to-wall Guinness all the way through, isn't it? Which is welcome to Dublin. It's amazing. And I think, I mean, Guinness is famous for having very distinctive assets. Yeah. So how old are the assets? How do you know which ones are valuable? I mean, I discovered on my tour earlier that the heart, for example, goes back to 1860, which is incredible.
Yeah, exactly. So the harp's been around, you know, for kind of basically all of modern day history on the brand. And you will see the harp on every pint, glass, bottle, and actually irrespective of market. You know, so even though our cousins in Lagos or Kenya don't know maybe where Ireland is or the link to Ireland, there's a harp in every bottle. So I think the harp is probably our most beautiful, actually, and distinctive asset. It is actually a national symbol of Ireland, as I mentioned, you know, and the design actually comes from a harp called the Brian Boru harp, which there's a replica of here, actually, here in the storehouse. We're experimenting more with our iconography and allowing consumers to experiment with this as well. And you'll see kind of on some of our merch, like how we put in like different colours in the harp, or, you know, there's a beautiful installation actually here on the third floor, which is this, we call it a fibre harp, which is, you know, a piece of sculpture actually. So the harp serves us really, really well. And interestingly, we don't even need to say the word Guinness anymore. You know, we can actually just put the harp and people go Guinness.
Now, I've actually got some data on this as well, because a couple of years ago, when you remember you did that brilliant surfboard in the beach?
Yes.
I think it was social out of home. And somebody sent it to me at System One and said, oh, would it work better if you put the harp in there? And I said, oh, well, let's test it. Let's see what difference the harp makes. It was incredible. It boosted the score on a 5-star scale. It added an extra star. But what's interesting about it was, as soon as people saw the harp, they immediately knew it was Guinness. And it just, and in the survey we sent out, people go, oh, the idea of having a Guinness on the beach sounds amazing. You know what I mean? So it just creates the association that just that harp creates in people's minds, yeah, and the emotion that it elicits is really powerful.
Yeah. And again, it's that down to that kind of really sticking with your KBAs, which I know sounds a bit marketing 101, but that's how those memory structures are built.
Now, have you got a book? Have you got like a book of like where, because what I'm interested to know is like, mm-hmm, where are the limits of how much you can play with them? Because they're, you know, they go back a long time. They're very distinctive. You're really well known for them. You know, how do you decide, yeah, as the brand director?
Yeah, no,
when people can and can't play?
We have a brand world kind of set of guidelines, you know, which of course now is kind of all online and that's distributed out to the markets, but it's refreshed probably every year. And of course, as we add in innovations, add in things like 00, you know, we update and we create kind of brand worlds for those. So that's kind of how we keep the discipline on it. But what's interesting, even more so beyond kind of just even kind of internally, like Diageo, is consumers are creating loads of content, you know, on Guinness now. And we have a very, very vibrant set of communities, as you can imagine, on Guinness, which is absolutely fabulous. We have communities on Nitro Surge, by the way, who take pictures or videos of pouring a Nitro Surge at home and share it with them, which is like fabulous, you know. But point is, there's a lot of user generated content there. And I think what you want to do is kind of free up your KBAs and be generous kind of with your KBAs, let people play with them. But obviously, we have a brand to protect and be cohesive on as well. Generally speaking, like, people are really respectful around like things like the harp, etc., while still kind of playing with it, because they really like it, and it's a thing of beauty, like, in its own right, you know.
Now, I have a bit of a theory that the stronger the brand, the more you can sell merchandising, because I think merchandising is incredible, because you've got people coming here paying to advertise your brand on their t-shirt, which, when you think about it as a marketing stunt, is incredible. But it's a mark of the power of the brand, isn't it? That people want to wear the merch. I mean, usually most brands, you wouldn't dream of going, I wouldn't walk around wearing that brand, you know, at the weekend. But Guinness somehow has become that brand that people are very proud to wear and show off.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's that kind of like proud to be seen drinking or proud to be seen with Typeece. And Guinness scores really, really highly, you know, on that, because, yeah, not just that it's cool, I think it's because the values of the brand, it kind of says something about you, you know, when you're either holding a pint of Guinness or indeed you're kind of wearing like a t-shirt. And yeah, we have a very successful merchandise business on the Guinness brand. It's been on the go for a long time, by the way, as well. Like, we've been doing licensing for many, many years. What's great to see now is, I mean, I think it's really fascinating. I actually see merchandising as almost like another P within the five P's or whatever, if you get me, right? I think it's a marketing lever our growth driver in its own right. And that's kind of how we're talking about this with our meat merchandising team, which is there's almost like two aspects to this. One is the revenue generation, obviously, but the other is actually like brand heat. And I actually think there's even more value in the brand heat sort of side of things, you know. And when you've got people coming in here, we have regular celebrity visitors, but when Rita Ora arrives and then leaves basically head to toe in Guinness
money
merchandise,
can't buy that, right?
You know you're onto something, right? Yeah, etc. You know, so what's really brilliant about what we're doing on the merch kind of now is we've obviously kind of got like different layers or tiers, like any kind of apparel kind of brand. But some of our collaborations, you know, we're really, really proud of, you know. So there's the Le Brum recent collaboration, and that was very carefully thought about and chosen. And the reason being is that he's from Sierra Leone. Right, was born there, obviously raised in, like, you know, the UK. But Sierra Leone was the first market to which we exported Guinness in Africa. And again, back to your kind of story about my family, he grew up with the brand in kind of mind, you know. So I guess, and the other then is Fatty Burke, recent collaboration as well. And there's more and more, you know, of those kind of coming. And what it does, it becomes more than a garment. It becomes a story in its own right, you know, plus they're very cool.
Now, I want to talk about one of my favorite strap lines of all time. Good things come to those who wait.
Yep.
But we've been chatting for a while and we haven't yet had a Guinness. So this might be the moment.
I know, and this is thirsty work.
This is very thirsty work. So this might be the moment to get our man here to pour us a pint. As he does so, how long does it take to pour the perfect Guinness?
It is very, very precise. It is 119.5 seconds.
Ooh, 0.5.
It is that 0.5, that makes or breaks. But back to kind of like the story on kind of quality, kind of good things come to those who wait. Kind of started in the campaign was kind of being conceived mid-90s. But then, of course, we have our very famous surfer ad. Okay, what is with us in surfing? that was shot in 98 and went on air in 99. And again, one ad of the century, you know, an extremely famous ad. And the whole piece behind that is we're probably a little bit self-conscious about how long it took to pour a pint, you know. And of course, at that time, customers were kind of got frustrated and they didn't want to do the two-part pour. They're just like, for God's sake, that just takes forever. Yeah. Of course, that has completely changed now, because we've just totally put that message out there and we've taken, I guess, what would have been historically a nuisance and turned it into a venture, you know. And I like to kind of think, you know, if you think of your mental health, it's all about it being in the moment, isn't it? And being present. And I'm like, there's no better way to be in the present than just to like chill and wait, you know, for your pint.
Now talking about having a pint in Dublin in the storehouse, right? I want to ask you about this, the myth that Guinness tastes better in Dublin. Now, I've got some real Guinness fans amongst my friends, all of whom swear that a Guinness tastes better in Dublin. Can you confirm or deny if that's true?
There's no difference, you know, in that, like, every pint of Guinness sold in GB or indeed in the US or in Europe comes from here. Yeah. So it's exactly the same.
Has it always been that way, by the way?
No, not always. So as I mentioned, I joined as a graduate and I was based in Parkwell. So we brewed there probably from the 40s or 50s, I would have thought, you know, up until we then brought everything back to Dublin. But every pint now, it comes directly from here and is put straight into kegs, etc. So there's no science reason for it. But I guess it's that kind of situation kind of moment. You know, I guess like the snow is more enjoyable in Lapland, you know, situation is everything. But yeah, a lot of people say that, but yeah, there's absolutely no difference other than maybe a little bit of
probably the association, the feeling, like Christmas, isn't it? Like the home of
exactly.
Guinness. And, you know,
yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's that Christmas feeling, you know.
So we are counting, did you say 194? Is that right?
No, 119.5.
119.5.
Yeah.
There we go. So we have done we almost completed our waiting. We're proving the point here ourselves, aren't we?
Thank you very much.
Look at that.
Yeah,
that's
still settling.
We'll give it another moment. So you talked about the surf rad. How big an impact did that campaign have? Because it's one of those things that's still talked about today. If you, you know, if you listen to the top ads of all time, you can guarantee that that surfer ad is up there. What impact did it have on the business?
Yeah, massive. You know, I think because of the, it was just so head snappy, you know, and it's such a beautifully told story. But I guess, so it's a great piece of advertising. It won Ad of the Century, as I mentioned, and it ran for years. It established that whole piece on the brand, you know, which has endured, as you say, like we're talking about it now, right? There's a few other ads as well that are quite successful.
Well, we'll come on to that. Just before we do, a good tee up there is another ad that's been running for a long time that probably doesn't get the recognition I think it deserves is your Christmas ad.
I know.
People might not realize this, but it's run for something like over 20 years, hasn't it? Your Christmas ad.
Correct.
Am I right in saying you once attempted not to run it?
Yes. Okay. And I think it's safe to kind of talk about
safe
it.
Safe to admit this.
It reminds me, actually. So Surfer's 25 years old this year.
Yeah.
And then Christmas Card, that's what we call it, is 20 years on the go this year. And me, in my wisdom, when I took the marketing director Western Europe role, decided in my first few months that, you know, the ad had worn out. I'm like, let's do something different. Let's move on, you know. So about a week into the time when that ad would usually go on air, the kind of radio stations and national news basically all kind of started to blow up and kind of going, they've cancelled Christmas.
You went from the most popular man in Ireland to the least popular, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, so suffice to say that ad went up like within a day and it's been up ever since, you know. So it's really, again, like just the iconic nature of the brand. Like people say, in announces Christmas.
In the UK, like the Coke truck ad has a similar kind of role to play. And I remember when talking about it on LinkedIn, I got loads of messages from Guinness employers going, have you tested the Christmas ad? Because we reckon it does the same. You know, and I didn't. It was five and a half stars, something like that. It's amazing.
Wow.
Yeah, it really is. And it's all that emotion. Everyone said in the survey, Christmas starts when I see the Guinness ad.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. By the way, Sláinte.
Oh, Sláinte.
There you think. There we go.
Okay.
This is how you do it. This is how you do podcast interviews. Mm. So, should we talk about your ads?
Yes,
please. You've made a few, right? So, what would be your, what are you most proud of?
What's interesting actually is, again, like the journey, you know, the brand has been on from a kind of a story, kind of telling kind of point of view. When I came up back onto the brand doing the marketing director of Western Europe, the line was called Made of More, which again ran for kind of many, many years. And it was interesting, I was handed essentially two scripts and told, go make those. And the first script was called Cloud and the second script was called Clock, you know, and it was very imaginative in that it was kind of talking about a cloud made of more or indeed a clock made of more, which was very mind expanding, you know, thinking, and spent a very interesting week, I would say, in Johannesburg, looking at poor extras and actors pointing at some sort of like imaginary cloud. Of course, it was all CGI, right? This cloud made of more, etc. So that was kind of interesting to make. And it was an amazing film craft. In fact, I won a Canline Gold for film craft, which is phenomenal. It was AMV BBDO, where the agency. So that was kind of that one. Then we made Clock, which is this incredible clock that could kind of turn back time, et cetera, you know. But what was interesting, and like they researched really well, like they performed quite well. But my kind of sense was Guinness is such a human brand. Like it's got like humanity and people at the core. Why are we telling these they're really interesting, but like kind of why are we focusing on these kind of abstract things, you know, to tell a story about being made of more? And I think the other kind of piece was kind of as we were thinking about the made of more line, you know, it's kind of like, well, we want to shine a light on people of incredible strength of character and integrity. And that was the one line brief, you know. And from that came an ad called Supper, which again ran for many, many years. But it was based on a book by Paul Smith. And it is a true story, which is this bunch of gentlemen in Brazzaville in the Congo, of all places, who dressed, well, you know, they dressed really dapper, okay? And this was kind of like their thing. They called it Paris London style, you know, because that they kind of saw how people, you know, wore, the gentlemen of the time would have worn like suits and all that kind of stuff and like very kind of dandyish, et cetera, et cetera. And we just happened on this and we just kind of went, this is such an incredible human story. Because again, if you kind of think about it, you know, Civil War, a very troubled kind of part of the world. And they talk, like we did a documentary as well, which is also really fascinating, if a little bit heartbreaking, because they talked about, you know, when you know, the Civil War was happening, that they dug holes in the ground and buried their clothes in it to cover it up so it wouldn't get stolen. And luckily they were able to come back, you know, when things kind of calmed down, get their clothes back out again and wear them. But we shot that ad not in the Congo. We wouldn't be able to get the insurance, unfortunately, you know, so we shot it actually in Durban in South Africa, because it had a very similar kind of like, whatever, foliage and all that kind of stuff. But we did fly the guys down, right?
Oh,
and there
brilliant.
There were, I think, 12 in total, I think. And we had to get them passports, you know, because none of them had been actually outside, you know, Congo ever. But we brought them down and it was just like absolutely fabulous to kind of meet them. And of course, we had a wonderful wardrobe agency who just went wild, obviously, but all these like pink shirts and yellow shirts and neon ties. And it was just the more colorful and dandyish, like, you know, the better. And it was, yeah, it was a fabulous shoot. And we just knew when we were shooting it, that it was just going to be gold. But again, like, you kind of have to laugh about, like, the road to great creative is not straightforward,
is it?
No, yeah, there's no guarantees in the creative process. But I always remember in one of our Project Gladiator meetings when we were trying to fix our issues in the on-trade, showing them the ad and kind of being a little bit, you know, given, like, you know, the crisis we were facing, and I'm digging up this, I have this ad about the gentleman, you know, of the Congo, you know, that they'd kind of be looking at me.
I could just
funny.
Imagine that. I've just been to South Africa, been shooting a film, we got these Congo guys, and me, yeah, sales the on-trade
so,
down.
So I showed, yeah, exactly, you know, so I showed them the ad, and there was kind of like a silence, and the one guy just said, "That's interesting." And I was like, okay.
You know? I think you've just described every marketer's experience, haven't you? Like, we've all been there, haven't we? That moment you've spent all this time on an ad, you show it to the people that are important.
Honestly, some of the loneliest moments in my life have been pressing the button on an ad going on air.
Yeah.
Everybody seems to scatter.
That tumbleweed moment.
Yeah, you know, so you do have to kind of believe, you know, in it. And look, it's performed brilliantly. It's kind of, again, run for years, et cetera, et cetera. But it also, it kind of got us into a vibe in terms of kind of like, you know, shining the light. You know, again, it gave us a platform, if that makes sense, you know, not just like an ad.
One of the most impactful, certainly that you know, as I looked at, maybe seen as brave at the time, that really had an impact that very noticeable, was what you did with Gareth Thomas, of course, around the time. Tell me a bit more about that.
Yeah, you know, so it was part of the Made of Morp campaign. And, you know, the whole idea of that kind of was to really shine a light on people of just incredible strength of character and integrity. And, you know, in the subject of Gareth, he came out as gay in 2009 within, like, you know, as part of a rugby team and a very high profile person within the Welsh kind of rugby scene. And the story just tells his story of coming out, you know, which was incredibly brave, obviously, but also it tells the story of the team around him who were kind of like, who cares, you know, and were just incredibly supportive. And we just thought it was really, really charming. Again, no creative path is kind of straightforward, you know, but I always remember taking the script into our president of Europe at the time. Yeah, with some trepidation, kind of going, oh, you know, like, am I pushing it too far here? You know, how could he react, or how my consumers react, et cetera, et cetera. And I always just remember to this day his reaction, which is, we've got to make this ad.
No, it's very powerful and authentic as well, which I think when you're dealing with a topic like that, authenticity is
absolutely
incredibly powerful.
Yeah, people will. Yeah, exactly. People will spot opportunistic kind of marketing.
And you're linked to rugby and the players. So the whole thing was very, very authentic and well done.
Yeah, exactly. And it kind of takes us even to modern day and our association with women's.
Yes, of course.
Rugby.
Yeah.
So we've recently signed up as title sponsorship of the Women's Six Nations Championship. But that's a really interesting kind of story as well. Again, just in terms of, you know, that boldness and bravery, you know, that I just feel so proud of on Guinness. And I think consumers do as well, because that's been 4 years in the making, right? the first kind of move with Six Nations is we became an official sponsor, but not the title sponsor at that time. But, you know, we really kind of show Guinness as a force for good for the women's sport. I think really prove ourselves to the Six Nations leadership, you know, that we were serious about really raising profile of the women's game. We were one of the first brands to actually advertise, like, you know, with female protagonists. So we had Sisters, which I think when we made the announcement of the official sponsor, and we featured like the Japanese rugby team, which is again just only Guinness could. The other kind of piece we kind of really felt was important was about 6% or something like that of all kind of like media coverage and broadcast coverage, you know, of female sport, of sports in general, was female. And we kind of really wanted to kind of go on a mission to raise, therefore, the visibility of that, but also attendance at the matches, you know, because as they were building out the women's kind of sport, sometimes attendance would be quite small. So again, like all of our activation, really promoting the sport, et cetera, has really raised the visibility. And then you think of things like, you know, the number of female drinkers in UK is up 24%.
It's amazing on tap potential. On a brand I used to work on Lucozade, we sponsored the Lionesses. And I remember at the 2016, 2017.
Yeah.
I remember the FA saying, I can have as many tickets as I want to any game. And I was really confused going, well, you know, surely, you know, you're not going to do that. And they said, yeah, of course. And at Wembley, there'll be 7,000 or 8,000 seeing a women's game. Now Wembley's packed, you know, so literally in 5 years, gone from, you know, tiny attenders, which is great. It's so exciting.
Absolutely. And we're seeing similar increases as well, but like still work to do, you know, so that's why I'm delighted. We've signed up for another 4 years, you know, and let's see how the next few weeks going to play out as best team win.
Indeed. Exciting to watch. I want to talk as well about brand extensions, because after 258 years or whatever that we're up to now, you've launched an alcohol-free version. Now, there are brands like Lucky Saint that have, you know, established the brilliantly alcohol-free positionings. But I guess with Guinness, the thing is, people have got a reference point. Yeah. So how do you go, how long did it take you, in the spirit of good things comes to those who wait, how long did it take to get to a 0% formulation that you're happy with?
Yeah, well, we call it the game changer. Yeah, for a number of reasons. Let's start with the liquid kind of first, because you're dead right. Like a beautiful but complex, you know, multi-layered kind of liquid like Guinness is very hard to replicate, you know, when you take out like different ingredients or you play with the kind of, you know, the recipe. But luckily, we have an amazing team of master brewers. It took them like years, not months, to perfect the recipe, to get it to a point where it is basically flavor matched. Like essentially exactly the same liquid experience. And obviously we track this continuously and get kind of, you know, feedback from consumers and customers alike, et cetera, and basically people are like, they can't believe how good it is, you know, given how complex like liquid, you know, Guinness is. And of course their expectations of quality and taste are so high. So we're so proud of the master brewers and getting to that. And you're right, you know, people have a reference point, you know, so they're always going to and should compare back to the original pint. So we're delighted with that. And it is incredibly successful. It's opening up kind of really different occasions for Guinness, like so more midweek, for instance, occasions, or an after work kind of piece, or indeed through can, you know, people having, you know, like enjoying like cans of 00 at home again, maybe midweek, etc. And it's also opening up kind of new consumers, you know, and younger consumers. And you know, there's a lot of, you know, younger consumers who either don't drink alcohol or moderate, and they absolutely love having something like 00 because it allows them to enjoy the kind of camaraderie and the community, I guess, that come with being either in the pub or with their mates, you know, but with none of the alcohol.
And presumably it gives you an element of future proofing, because with regulations, I'm expecting to get tighter and tighter around what you can and can't advertise. Yeah. This gives you a potential future proof as well.
It does, you know, although we would be, I mean, look, you know, we would probably hold a really, really high bar in terms of like, we always kind of meet kind of like the rules and regulations, not just to the latter, the spirit, right? You know, and those rules and regulations, as you say, like darkening markets or whatever, are there for a reason. For us, we have our Diageo marketing code, which again is kind of designed to ensure like that we are completely compliant with that and we're marketing responsibly. We would apply that to a zero product as well. So we'll see, you know, how things play out. But yes, if a market kind of goes darker, or there are kind of more restrictions put on our marketing freedoms, then yes, Xero could offer some flex.
And congratulations, by the way, on the success of Singing Pints, which I love. So I did check this on the System One database. 4.4 star. So wow. Well done. In the top 3 or 4% on our database of all beer ads, which is really good. And we have the long and short measure, right? The short measure being spike 1.53. Okay. So one of the spikiest we've ever seen as well, which is really good. So not only is 0% cutting through, but you know, the advertising itself is working very, very well.
Yeah, no, delighted with that. And actually that is live at the moment as we speak in Ireland, but also GB and US. So in three of our most developed kind of markets. So it's great to, again, you know, see advertising travel and copy, you know, traveling. And it's more sustainable as well.
It is more sustainable. Now, just quickly for everybody, describe the ad as well, because it's very simple, very beautifully done. But just describe it.
Yeah, so basically it's basically a close-up on, I think it's three pints, and there is like little faces, essentially, like, and they're animated. So they sing, you know, and they're singing to Bonnie Tyler's I Need a Hero, right? Of course. And the whole kind of concept behind it was like, this is the hero of Xero's, like, you know, but also it's like, it's that not the designated driver, or, you know, or I need that thing that comes to the rescue if I want to go out and enjoy myself, but I, you know, with none of the alcohol. So what it does, actually, I think really successfully, is it has that kind of twinkle in the eye for what could be, maybe it could be like more functional message, you know what I mean? 100% Guinness, 0% alcohol, that's fine. But, you know, we want to kind of push it, you know, so I think it brings that kind of twinkle, you know, in the eye kind of aspect, and makes people smile, you know. I'm delighted to hear it's performed so well,
brilliantly,
because it's, yeah, on air in our three most important markets.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Good things happening. So last question I'm going to leave to our friend Ritson.
Sure.
And interesting, I did ask him, I said, go on.
Friends of the Browns.
Yeah, exactly. Big fan of Guinness, you know, absolutely massive fan. And wrote a Marketing Week article about it last year, I think the fact that you got to number one pint in the UK was the trigger for that. So very, very well done. Interesting question he asked. He said, how does the team remain so humble with all the success?
Yeah, interesting question, given I've just been rambling on for whatever 40 minutes about me and Guinness and my advertising. All jokes aside, I think it comes back, I think, to the values of the brand. You know, again, we believe in the power and goodness of communion. And as you know, as we were kind of talking about Garth and these stories, like, it is a very rooted brand, you know, so I think that kind of keeps our feet on the ground in a really, really good way. And I think the other piece is, like, it is like, it's a brand that's been around for 1759. And I think I'm kind of looking around at these pictures here behind me. We just see ourselves as custodians of the brand. And we care so, so much, you know, about the reputation of the brand, you know, about the growth, you know, moving the brand on, you know, ensuring the next chapter of growth, you know, and of course that we're shaping the future of the brand to sustain it, right, into the future. So that keeps us rooted as well. And it's also part of a long story, right? You know, so it's interesting, like, you know, people kind of see some of the kind of success on Guinness as recent, but actually, you know, knowing the brand really, really well, you can just see that kind of steady, steady growth, innovations coming in, you know, geographical expansion there, you know, since 1759, you know, so our job obviously is to take that to the next level. And I think the other piece is, if I reflect on the values of Diageo as an organization, and it's a very values and purpose-driven organization. And I think we are educated and trained in that way. And it's in all of our, you know, company meetings and our broadcasts and et cetera, et cetera. You know, so I think it's very much between those two things, but it's definitely very much the organization as well as just the brand.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And good things have come to those that have waited for it.
Indeed.
So
nice to
circle back to that. Seem, thank you so much. It's been an absolute blast. And thank you for your generosity as well, hosting it in the storehouse. And, you know, we're in the concert bar with Arthur Guinness just over the, looking over our shoulders.
Yeah,
so
keeping an eye on me. Yeah.
And it's great to have a pint of Guinness and do a podcast. So that was wonderful.
Sláinte.
Sláinte.
Okay. Take care.
Thank you very much for listening or watching Uncensored CMO. I hope you enjoyed that. If you did, please do hit the subscribe button wherever you get your podcast. If you're watching, hit subscribe there as well. I'd also love to get a review. Reviews make a big difference on other people discovering the show. So please do leave a review wherever you get your podcast. If you want to contact me, you can do. I'm over on X at Uncensored CMO or on LinkedIn, where I'm under my own name, John Evans. Thanks for listening and watching. I'll see you next time.